Welcome to the Unsweetened SIO podcast. My name is Siobhan Harris. I am a certified integrative nutrition health coach and the founder of unsweetenedsio.com. I gave up all sugar and all flour on January 13th, 2018, and am finally free of my addiction. My mission is to help other sugar addicts find their path to freedom and live the sweet life without sugar. Hi, everyone, and welcome to episode 88 of Unsweetened SIO, the podcast. Today, I have a very special guest, Shia Mercer. She's a nutritional counselor at Northwest Life Medicine Clinic, a naturopathic medical practice in Bellingham, Washington. Her passion for nutritional and spiritual wellness was born out of her desire to recover her own health and sense purpose after burning out from working in film and television production. With over 15 years in private practice, her unique blend of health coaching, nutritional therapy, and spiritual support has helped hundreds of clients across the US and around the world heal their relationship with food and themselves. Welcome, Shia.
Thanks for having me.
Yeah, super excited for you to kind of share a little bit about your own journey with us and about the work that you do now. I think it's going to really resonate with a lot of our listeners. So let's just dive in and talk to us a little bit about your own health journey. And like you said, you know, in the intro, you went from film and television to now being a nutritional counselor. So talk to us a little bit about that.
Sure. I mean, there's a lot to tell, but the long and the short of it is I think I had a pretty standard relationship with food, you know, for an American kid growing up in the 70s and 80s. Lots of sugar, but also, you know, plenty of really good whole foods. So I had sort of experienced both. But then when I went off to college, you know, knew how to make a cup of noodles and, you know, mac and cheese out of a box and all that kind of stuff. So I dove right into a you know, budding career in film and television, which if you don't know about film and television, it's really long hours, very, you know, tough work on your feet all day. I was in physical production, which means I was on set and location. And there's just not, looking back on it, I realized there's just a lifestyle of getting up with a ton of coffee, probably some sugary donuts or pastries, maybe a breakfast burrito. There's something called craft service. And when you work on a set, there's catering. So long hours, grueling schedule, a certain amount of boredom between, you know, the activities of the day, and just tons of access to food. And so over, you know, my 14 or so years working in film and television, I got increasingly tired and had a lot of inflammation, not knowing what inflammation was at the time, and started gaining a lot of weight and just started going down the road that a lot of folks in our, you know, in our sort of modern Western culture are going down, which is, you know, I imagine that if I'd stayed on that path, I would probably be your poster child for pre-diabetes and type 2 diabetes and syndrome X and, you know, fibromyalgia and all the things if I had continued to eat and live in that way. Not luckily, but I was rear-ended. And so I needed to go to a chiropractor, and I'd been having a lot of chronic sinus issues, chronic sinus headaches and sinusitis. And my medical doctor had wanted to put me on a steroid spray and actually gotten me a little inhaler to, and it was just awful. It burned my sinuses and it was just terrible. And I just happened to be going to this chiropractor for my neck and told him about my sinuses. And he was like, have you ever seen this book, you know, Prescriptions for Nutritional Healing, which is like a Bible. And he had me read about Candida. And it just blew my mind. I think I was about 23 at the time. And that was my first entree into understanding that we could actually heal ourselves with food and supplements and change our diet and change our health. And it took me a long time to actually get to where I was able to have some mastery around feeding myself well and really healing my body. But that was the inciting incident, the sort of spark that got me started. Eventually I ended up, you know, just realizing that my diet and lifestyle working in the film industry wasn't supportive of the healing journey I wanted to be on. And I was living in New York City ultimately and discovered the Institute for Integrative Nutrition. And I feel like I kept meeting people who had gone through that program. It was in its early years and I was really intrigued, but I was still freelancing in film. And when you're freelancing in film, it's really hard to commit to anything else because you never know when you're going to be working, and when you're working, you can't do anything else. So it took me a long time until I finally decided to just get like a, what I would call a day job with a regular schedule, and I could actually do the program. And then, you know, from there, just added lots of different trainings and certifications on top for all kinds of body, mind, and spirit healing experiences.
And that's pretty cool that you learn. I mean, even age 23, just to be introduced to that is good. You know, some people don't start the journey even that early, because like you said, I think for everyone, he might get introduced to that concept of what, you know, nutrition and how that can heal your body. But it does take a little while, like you said, to master it or really explore everything that goes into that. It's not like you discover it one day and you're like, flip the switch the next day. It does take some time and experimentation. So, and I also went to IIN, which is really cool. I think, you know, we were talking about the differences in the program from, you know, when you started and I started, but I think it's just such a good base for anyone interested in learning how to, you know, or just that your body is amazing and can heal itself if given the right tools, and nutrition being a big part of that. So what other, I just think it is really fascinating, all the other things that you've kind of added to your repertoire here to help the clients that you see. Talk a little bit more about those other things that you've done and how you work with clients now, like what your approach is.
Yeah. So I would say that, you know, when I was 23, like I said, the chiropractor turned me on to prescriptions for nutritional healing, but it took me almost 11 years. Well, exactly 11 years. I was 34 when I went to IIN. So what happened in the meantime, I got, you know, a day job working in philanthropy, still living in New York City. And I was having a lot of chronic joint pain. And I just felt like my immune system was really not great. I felt like I was catching every cold that came around. And I had started eating a lot more healthy whole foods. I was actually working in environmental philanthropy before everyone was like aware of GMOs and things like that. So I was learning about our food supply and about the health of the planet and about food security and food systems from an environmental point of view and a sort of environmental justice point of view. So I was really getting a good education around what was going on with our food supply and how toxic it could be. So I was paying attention, you know, eating organic and things like that, but I was still, you know, just eating and drinking too much and, you know, sort of a foodie living in New York City. You'd eat really late, stay up late, drink lots of wine, eat all the things, desserts and things like that. So I was having these sort of chronic health issues, even though I was doing a lot better than I had been when I was working in film. And I went to a naturopath, and that naturopath does a very specific naturopathic method of assessing food intolerances. And I had taken myself off of wheat because I'd had an allergy test that said I was allergic to wheat. And when you go off of wheat, if you start eating a lot of gluten-free products, you start leaning into like potatoes more if you don't know any better, which I didn't at the time. And it turned out that I was intolerant to potatoes and the combination of dairy with sugar. And I'd always wondered about dairy. I had, you know, initially when I saw that chiropractor and read prescriptions for nutritional healing, I went off of wheat and dairy and it made a huge difference. But it had slowly crept back in. And so this food intolerance assessment, I got off of potatoes, I got off of sugar, and I started losing weight. My energy was better. My joints started feeling better. I mean, I thought I was getting rheumatoid arthritis, and I was probably on my way to that. I had gone to a medical doctor who had pretty much, you know, said I was probably, you know, I could do the testing, but he could guess that I was probably having autoimmune issues with my joints. So this naturopathic method of food intolerance assessment, again, was like a turning point in my health, because I then, you know, got off of all the potatoes, all the sugar, my health started just, you know, turning around just by doing that. And it was so inspiring to me that it made such a difference for me that I considered becoming a naturopath. And I talked to my naturopath, who was sort of becoming a mentor at this point. And he said, you know what? There are lots of naturopaths, but just like regular doctors, naturopaths don't have the time to really take to sit with people and help them learn how to feed themselves well. Like, we can tell them what not to eat, or we can tell them what to eat, but we're not there to help them do it. And he saw that I was struggling to make these changes work in my own diet, but I was already, you know, I knew how to cook for myself and I knew how to shop. And so it was easier for me than it might've been for me when I had been, you know, 23 years old. But he just really encouraged me to consider nutrition. He had started with nutrition and then become a naturopath. And so that, and I, even though I'd already heard of IIN, that really inspired me to go do the IIN program. And then I partnered with him, and he would do the food intolerance assessments, and I would support his patients with nutrition. And then he would also do the food intolerance assessment for my clients, my nutrition clients. And so that's sort of how I launched off in my nutritional counseling career, health coaching. Back then we were called holistic health counselors, because there's a lot of emotional counseling around our relationship with food in that program, which I really appreciated. And then after completing that program, I immediately launched into another program called the Nutritional Therapy Association program and became a nutritional therapy practitioner. And now it's called a functional nutritional therapy practitioner, because these programs evolve and change as we do. And I loved that program because that gave me more assessment tools to be able to really, you know, kind of see what's going on for someone nutritionally with the different organ systems that affect our nutrition and likewise are affected by nutrition. And it just gave me a lot of tools and methods for prescribing different dietary recommendations, but also supplementation that would help people heal their bodies. Because changing our diet is one thing, but it can be a slow going process. And it also can be a really challenging process, because if you're, say, craving coffee because your adrenals are fatigued, it's really hard to just say quit coffee, because someone's just going to be exhausted. So you really want to support their adrenal glands and get their energy back up. And likewise with sugar and wheat and all these things that we want to help people, you know, break their addictions with, we need to be able to support the physical body in functioning well, or it's just a trap. So I was really appreciative of everything I gathered from that training. But I still felt like, especially with a lot of clients who are just still struggling, it's like I was educating them, I was giving them all the information, doing all the assessment, and able to say, here's what's going on for you. And even though they had all that information, they still sometimes weren't having breakthroughs, the kind of breakthroughs that would really help them heal themselves. And so I actually took a clairvoyant psychic healing course, because I'd always felt like I had a really strong intuition, but I felt like there was more going on for people. People were stuck, and it wasn't a lack of information. It wasn't a lack of knowing what to do. It was actually like a sort of mental, emotional, energetic, and spiritual block to their ability to have good health or be a healthy, vibrant person. And so I, you know, that sort of launched me on a self, you know, I'm all about self-awareness and self-discovery as our best tool for healing, because if we're living with information in our blind spots, we can't get there from here. So, so that, you know, then evolved into studying some Hakomi psychology training, which is sort of a somatic psychology course that's very intuitive. And I thought about becoming a psychotherapist because I really wanted to help people with their emotional relationship with food. But I realized, again, there are a lot of psychotherapists out there. There aren't a lot of nutritional counselors who can help people break through around food. So I stuck with nutritional counseling, but just started to add more and more in. I did a 4 years of training, intensive training in shamanic healing, and a program called Psychology of Symptoms, which again was an intuitive way to work with the body, and something called voice dialogue, where we talk to our different sort of personality pieces, you know. So we might have the part of us that really wants to heal, but we might also have a part of us that's a little bit more of a saboteur that really wants to eat the donut. And so it's a way of learning how to communicate with all these different parts of our own personalities and things like that. And I studied advanced meditation, Tibetan Buddhist meditation, for almost 10 years and really learned how meditation and mindfulness can help us also with making these big, huge changes and making them lasting and sustainable from a place of self-awareness and healing all the places where we feel stuck or sabotage ourselves. Did that answer your question?
Yeah, that's amazing. I'm just like writing down all these things. And I mean, how you can help. I'm just curious on what you saw now as you're adding all this additional training. What were the breakthroughs that you saw with clients? Like, you know, I'm really curious on how you even kind of approach, if you have someone that comes to you, walk us through like how you would kind of help them, how you start the assessment. I just think it's so fascinating that you have all these tools that you can use to help someone. Cause I do think you're right. There's so many layers and layers and layers. So it's like, you know, you're able to support them very individualized and kind of all different areas of healing, which is really cool.
Yeah. Well, I guess, I mean, it's so individual. You know, the one thing I think this was my major takeaway from IIN, and it's always been my sort of mantra. There's no one way of healing that works for everyone all the time. And you could say there's no one diet that works for everyone all the time, but I also say there's no one way of healing because it's not just about food. And so I love having all these different tools because each person who comes in, I can approach and just meet them where they are. So I kind of start where they are, and in dialoguing with them in our initial intake, I can sort of suss out whether we need to start with just the practical physical body and how we're eating. And I usually do anyway, start there. Like I'll start with hydration and chewing really well and being, you know, relaxed when we eat and things like that, just basic stuff. And I'm always taking someone through a nutritional curriculum, whole foods, you know, based, nutrient dense, well-rounded, that works for everyone. But, you know, working on the physical plane with food, what I'll do is I use the food intolerance assessment. I look at blood type, you know, recommendations. I look at body type and metabolic type recommendations as just sort of a way to help them dial in, you know, what foods are going to be best for them to eat, which foods are going to be best for them to avoid. And that kind of helps take care of the physical. We talk about how to eat, how to be as an eater, chewing, mindfulness, things like that. But then, you know, as I take them through that, if there have been, you know, traumas and or I talk to people about what was their relationship like with food growing up or what have they tried now, a lot of times by the time people come to us at the clinic or even before I worked with the clinic, I had plenty of patients who'd never really tried anything before, but a lot of times it's people who feel like they've tried everything and they've just not been able to, you know, figure out what's going on or have sustained, you know, lasting results. And that's where, you know, if I have someone who just feels so stuck, then that's like, that just is a major flag for me that they need to have some mental, emotional, and spiritual support. And so it looks different with each patient, but I've had experiences with, well, for instance, for almost, I think, 3 years, I had become the nutritional counselor for a sobriety program called Go Sober. And it was a program that used a medical pharmaceutical proprietary approach to resetting people's GABA receptors and dopamine receptors so that they could actually quit alcohol. They had only a few days of withdrawal, but it was medically supervised. And then all of a sudden their craving for alcohol was just gone. But they often didn't know how to take care of themselves. So I was the nutritional counselor. And so they would come to me. And so even prior to that program, I had heard of some, you know, the work of Gabor Mate. I don't know if you've heard of him or done much. He's a he's an addiction. He's a medical doctor in Vancouver, BC, who works with heroin addicts. And, you know, in Vancouver, they're not always homeless. There's actually a homing program for heroin addicts. So they have a place to live and they have medical care. And he wrote a great book. I think it's called In the Realm of the Hungry Ghost or something like that, which is a Buddhist term for addiction. But the long and the short of it is that he discovered that, you know, addicts of all kinds either have extreme neglect or abuse. And so the people I work with are not always on that severe end of the spectrum, but our addictive habits often come out of some kind of trauma to our ego out of our early life. And so in working with this sobriety program, I was able to witness in a very short period of time, I only got 6-hour-long sessions with people over 6 weeks to help get them, you know, shopping, cooking, eating in a way that worked really well for their bodies. I wasn't able to do the food intolerance assessment with them because it wasn't part of the program. So it really made me, because the food intolerances are huge. I mean, it makes a huge difference for people right off the bat, because if you get off those foods, you're getting off of your most addictive, most destructive foods. But I didn't have that tool. So I had to really work with this idea that we all have coping mechanisms that help us cope with the stressors that we face. And a lot of those coping mechanisms were developed young. And so for extreme alcoholics, like I was working with in this program, it was alcohol primarily. But with most of my patients, it's food. A lot of times food is our biggest coping mechanism. And so just recognizing that there's that cycle of, you know, I wanna quit eating this, or I wanna quit drinking alcohol, but something in my life happens that's stressful and it triggers me to need my coping mechanism. And then I go and I eat my foods or I drink alcohol. And then we beat ourselves up for doing that, which causes more stress. And then we go to our stress mechanism, our coping mechanism. And so in working with people around that cycle, when we've had traumas or abuses spiritually, we lose parts of ourselves, parts of us, you know, sort of split off to protect themselves energetically, right? So you're following what I'm saying here. It's not, you know, we actually lose a physical arm, but, you know, a part of us, let's say we were a joyful kid and we had, you know, a caretaker who was verbally abusive, and that part of us that is super joyful and pure might have checked out to protect itself because it was not gonna go well to express when you were a kid. So in shamanic work, you can actually do spiritual energetic medicine work to help bring those parts of ourselves that we've lost back. So we can bring that joyful, exuberant part of ourselves back to us and become more whole and complete. And so I was able to do some of that work with some of the patients in the Go Sober programs, the ones that were open to it. I mean, obviously if someone's not open to energy work, I don't even necessarily bring it up. But if in talking to someone, it seems like they're open to doing something like that, it can be extremely powerful. So there were, you know, a handful of people that were still pretty stuck after, you know, getting the education around how to shop and eat and cook for themselves and what to eat and what not to eat. But doing that soul part retrieval work really helped them bring back the piece of themselves that had, you know, personal empowerment around taking care of themselves, because a lot of them had lost that part of themselves a long time ago. That's one example. There's another approach called voice dialogue, which is actually more of a psychological method. I had mentioned it before, those personality parts and pieces of ourselves. So I've worked with patients where, you know, literally they, again, know everything they need to do, but they find that they keep sabotaging themselves. And so there's a method for actually talking to that part of someone who really wants to heal and finding out what they need, and then talking to the part of them that is a rebel or is scared or wants to check out and needs to check out by eating their comfort foods, and finding out what they need to feel whole and what scares them, and how can we reconcile those two parts of ourselves that are working against each other and get them to work more cooperatively. And then, you know, the conscious self then recognizes those and with self-awareness can work with that. They can say, oh, okay, this is the part of me that feels scared that wants that donut. Let me, the conscious part of me, soothe that part and give it what it really needs, which is some kind of love and support or self-care, not a donut.
Exactly. Like, this is so huge, I think. And I bet so many people listening, that's really resonating with them. I know when, for me, I definitely felt like there was that two part, like I had a saboteur inside me when I was trying to give up sugar, and especially at first. I think even, you know, like you said, there's a lack of nutrition counselors, first of all, and, you know, medical world doesn't get any nutritional training, like doctors don't, and nurses. And then even like your naturopath said, they don't necessarily have the time then to coach people through it, you know, the actual. So I feel like, first of all, there's just such a need for nutritional counseling like this. But then that second piece, then not just that, because there's a lot of registered dietitians that are just gonna not personalize it, just, you know, kind of share what they've learned. But I think that's the big piece of it, is then taking it that one step further. Yeah, you have the information. There's no lack of information on nutrition right now. You know, you can go Google anything you want. There's tons of information. So why are people still not making the changes? And that's really, I think, the gift that you have, is really to address that for people in all these different ways, like all these different tools that you have, because I think that's the biggest change that people have to make it sustainable. You know, if, and for me, food for a long time was my coping mechanism. You have to find other ways, other coping mechanisms that are healthier. And so I think that's really cool that you can, you know, use all these different approaches that you've learned to kind of clear any kind of blockages people are having around eating healthy for themselves. I also think the food intolerance, I'd be curious to do that actually now. I did something like that and found out a long time ago that I was really sensitive to sugar. So I, you know, kind of knew that for a while, but I think that's just really, like what you said, you were sensitive to potatoes too. There's sometimes just random stuff that you don't even realize that's, you know, kind of causing issues. So I think just your approach, starting with the physical, but then delving into mental, emotional, spiritual, it's just an overall hits every plane, like you were saying, because sometimes it's not, there's some people that can probably benefit just from some nutritional suggestions, but I bet you find more often than not, it takes a little bit of deeper work. So I'm curious, since this is, you know, a podcast about sugar addiction, even though I think this information that you're sharing is helpful for anybody. So people that are listening, please share this with family and friends, because I think what Shia is talking about isn't just for sugar addicts. I mean, there's people that have intolerances, other things that are really suffering that don't need to, you know, there is help around this. But I'm just curious, how much sugar you see as sugar being an issue for your clients, and how you kind of help people specifically. I'm sure you see all sides of the spectrum, just some people that are a little sensitive to sugar, to the full out addict like me, you know, that has to abstain completely. But I'm curious what you've kind of noticed in the whole sugar world. I mean, you mentioned yourself that sugar plus dairy was an issue for you. So I'm curious what else you've seen kind of just in general with working with clients for all these years.
Yeah, absolutely. Well, first of all, I would say that, you know, in these 16 years that I've been working with this assessment, man, I wish I had thought of going back. I mean to go back and kind of do a statistical analysis of all the results, but I would say that probably, man, it might be even 90% of the people I work with have an intolerance to sugar. Wow. And when I'm talking about intolerances here, I'm not talking about the antibody response to food, like IgG testing. Those are food sensitivities, kind of delayed food sensitivities. But oftentimes when we've been eating our food intolerances, they're foods we don't fully metabolize and become metabolically toxic and inflammatory in our system, which can lead to a process of leaky gut, which can then lead to a food allergy process, which is more of a food sensitivity IgG thing. So it's possible to have both or some overlap there. And a lot of times people do have leaky gut because just because of the way we've been eating and living with so much stress.
But will you talk a little bit more, just since you brought up leaky gut, what that means? Because that is a term that's coming up more and more and more. And I don't know if everyone quite understands that. So if you could just talk a bit about it.
Leaky gut or gut permeability. So our digestive tract has a mucosal membrane that's meant to be an integral part of our immune system, meaning that it's a defense barrier. This mucous membrane is meant to be integral, or, you know, so with healthy digestion, we chew our food really well, we mechanically break it down. If our digestive enzymes, which start in the mouth with salivary amylase and other enzymes in saliva, we chew it really well, we swallow, let's say our stomach acid's perfect, our digestive acids, our enzymes are perfect, our bile salts are perfect, we can emulsify all the fats, we have perfectly digested food moving through our digestive tract. The mucosal membrane keeps any foreign invaders from getting through our digestive tract into our bloodstream, into our circulation. If something gets in there, our immune system attacks it as a foreign invader, right? With leaky gut, if that digestive process is broken down and we're not digesting well and we have maldigested foods moving through our digestive tract, combined with the effects of stress on our nutrients. So just the amount of stress we're living under alone is enough to kind of deplete us of the nutrients we need to maintain that healthy mucosal membrane. But then you add maldigestion and the toxicity and inflammation caused by not digesting our food well or eating foods that are toxic in the first place, sugar, caffeine, alcohol, and maldigested food, all these things conspire to sort of degrade that mucosal membrane. Now you have poorly broken down, poorly digested food bits, particles, proteins, able to slip through these gaps in the mucosal membrane. And those proteins get into our blood and our body, our immune system, calls out an emergency and sends, an immune response, antibodies, and we create antibodies against these food proteins. And then you have a food allergy. Does that make sense? Mm-hmm. It's kind of a simplistic way to talk about it, but it's not actually that complicated. Yeah. You can heal your gut. The first step is to take stressful food and drink out of your diet and to reduce the stress on your system, but also to supplement the nutrients we need to make good, healthy mucous membranes. And soothe and really heal that digestive tract and that mucous membrane and bring it back to health, which can take some time, but you absolutely foundationally must stop irritating and inflaming that digestive tract. And so getting off of your food intolerances is, in our experience, our first sort of line of defense against, a malnourished and overworked and underpaid mucosal membrane is to just stop stressing it with our intolerances. So let's say, 90% of the people I work with have a sugar intolerance. It's usually in combination with something else, but it's typically in combination with something that you commonly eat, like sugar with grain or sugar with dairy, but more often than not, it's sugar with fruit. And I would say not everyone I've ever worked with who is addicted to sugar had a sugar intolerance, but I can't think of a single client right now. In fact, my own mom doesn't have a sugar intolerance. She can take it or leave it. She's not addicted to sugar at all. She loves it. She loves ice cream. She likes to eat chocolate, but it doesn't impact her or affect her in the same way that it does to me because I have a sugar intolerance. And so I find that people who have a sugar intolerance are just going to be even more addicted to sugar, and it's going to have a more destructive effect on their body, because it's extra inflammatory and extra toxic to their system. And I use the analogy, which it's funny now in this day and age, it's less and less effective with younger people, but our food intolerances are a lot like cigarettes or alcohol. The first time anyone ever smoked, they would have felt nauseated and sick. and coughed, and their body would have had the appropriate response to a very toxic substance coming in their body. Same with alcohol. But if you push past that, you know, you see people, they become a smoker. They go from that first reaction to a toxin to being able to smoke 2 packs of cigarettes a day and not notice the difference. Those cigarettes are degrading their health, causing toxicity, inflammation, not good for them, but they come to rely on it, and they actually don't feel well if they don't smoke, because they're going to go through sort of a detoxification. Eating our food intolerances is similar. A lot, I think, and I don't have science behind me to prove this, but in my experience of working with pregnant and then lactating moms and young children, I think colicky babies often are being exposed to their food intolerances either through their mother's breast milk or through their first foods. And I've worked with a lot of families, and when they get off their food intolerances, all that sort of digestive upset and even some skin and eczema issues can clear right up. So coming back to sugar, I think that when we're sugar intolerant, which most of us are, not everyone, that just is fuel to the flame of sugar addiction, for sure.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's interesting you said about the pushing through. Like, well, I think sugar, unfortunately, is one of those things we're programmed like to just like right away, you know, like it doesn't, like a cigarette, yeah, most people are gonna be like, bleh, or alcohol, your first sip, you know, but sugar, unfortunately, are, you know, we are wired for the sweetness. But I remember for myself, I go through stages of kind of giving up, you know, sugar for a little bit and then fall off the wagon. And at first it was like too sweet for me. And I'd be like, okay, I just got to push through. Like, like I have to kind of, I remember actually thinking that, like, it's so funny. Like I'd just think, nope, I know, or it'd make me, I could feel it, you know, right away. But then, yeah, I kind of numbed myself to it again. Like, And then, like you said, then I had a problem getting off of it again. But it was interesting, really, when I look back, I did sometimes have a problem getting back on it too. So It is really fascinating to me. And you're right. I think starting to say before I interrupted you that I had the antibody, like the IgG or the, what did you say it was called?
Yeah, typically IgG are the more food sensitivity or what they would might. Yeah.
That's what I had done. And found out I was really sensitive to sugar, pineapples, and bananas was like mine that were in the very, you know, everything else was pretty within range, but that kind of gave me that first information. But what you're saying is the food intolerance test that you do is different than that.
Yeah. So it's not measuring immune response. It's measuring, it's a naturopathic test, and if we had millions of dollars to do the research science around it, we'd probably understand it. But as they map the human genome, I think we're going to start to get more and more answers. And there's also, when you consider a human being and human health, you have to consider the gut biome. So we are kind of a dynamic organism in the sense that our gut biome can be constantly reshaping itself for better or worse, depending on how we've been eating and living. So I think the health of the gut biome also plays a role here. So we do sometimes see people's food intolerances shift, but for the most part, it's sort of true about us, just like our shape of our eyes and our color of our eyes is true for us. So you and I are both human beings, right? So we have a head and 2 ears and 2 eyes and a mouth and a nose, but we don't look anything alike. I have, you know, dark brown hair, you're blonde, et cetera. You look like some perfect expression of the genes coming down from both sides of your family and expressing uniquely as you, and so do I. On the inside, we can't see it, but we both have protease to digest proteins and lipase to digest fats and amylase to digest starches and so on. But what your protease can break down and assimilate well, and what mine can look as different as what we physically look like. Does that make sense?
Yeah, I love the way.
We all have the same digestive enzymes, but what they're capable of might look very different. And that's where these food intolerances sort of come into play.
Yeah. Oh, I think that's so fascinating. I really want to get that done. And I'm going to make sure I link your information here in case people are interested in having that. Because again, I feel like any kind of data you can get on yourself is information is power. So that's a really good place to start. But I'm curious what other observations you've come to find. Anything, again, any tips that you could give to listeners that are maybe struggling with sugar addiction in particular, any kind of thing that you might want to share that you have found to be helpful? Because I know you coach people that are, you know, not everyone you coach, you kind of coach a lot of different types of people, but you do coach people that are addicted to sugar. So I'm curious if what you have found to be helpful, and then maybe even what you find the challenges to be for people too.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's a great question. So, I mean, I would say with food intolerances, because they are addictive, like cigarettes or alcohol, having new coping mechanisms that aren't food is very important. You mentioned that. So I usually recommend that people write down on a piece of paper and put it on their refrigerator three non-food coping mechanisms that they can go to instead of going and raiding the refrigerator. When I work with someone, we find out their intolerances and I help them find new products. So let's say it's a sugar intolerance. 99% of the bottled sauces, ketchups, and dressings out there have sugar in them. But there is this small burgeoning, you know, sort of whole 30 and paleo and keto friendly product lines coming out. So I help people identify what are they eating now, and okay, switch from this sauce to that sauce. So it can become very specific, finding products and recipes that work to avoid their food intolerances without them feeling deprived. Because I think, and this is where the mental, emotional, and spiritual work comes in, but feeling deprived of something that's been your coping mechanism is a very big, big challenge. And I don't recommend people try to go cold turkey. When I first tried to go off of wheat and sugar and dairy, I tried to go cold turkey, but I didn't know what else to eat. So that's why it took me 11 years to finally master my own diet. So I don't want people to have to wait 11 years. I mean, in just a matter of a couple of weeks, I can have them, you know, have a whole new pantry and fridge full of delicious foods they love and not feel deprived, but there's specific products that work for their intolerances. So sugar is just one example, but, you know, potato starch and tapioca syrup. And I mean, there's just, depending on what someone's intolerances are, I really help them personalize and customize their pantry and their recipes so that they're eating a lot of foods they've always loved, but they're just more digestible and less addictive to them because they don't include their food intolerances. When we eat our food intolerances, we have a very similar chemical response in the body that we do to having sugar, alcohol, or, you know, something like cigarettes or other drugs. They all have a very similar chemical response in the body that can become really addictive. So being sugar intolerant is like a double whammy. I really recommend that people also have their own treats. So if, let's say you work in an office and that office always has a candy dish or chocolates around the holidays, I absolutely recommend people buy something like coconut sweetened chocolate bars to keep in their desk drawer so that when everyone else is busting into the Halloween candy, they have something gentler that's not their addictive, you know, sugar. So it's, you know, it's a matter of just knowing how to shop for yourself and have your own little kind of survival kit for the world, because we don't live in a bubble. We're out there in the world. We're faced with decisions around food all day long. You know, if we work with the public or we work in an office. Right now during COVID, I would say it's been easier than ever to work with people and have them have really quick results, because a lot of people aren't going into an office or they're not eating at friends' houses or with relatives, because those are the biggest challenges.
Yeah.
But if someone can, you know, if you're a sugar addict to the point of like an alcoholic where you just can't touch it and you have to just abstain completely in order not to, you know, go down that addictive cycle, then I never recommend someone eat sugar or wheat for that matter. But for the most part, once people get off their food intolerances, they can sort of practice what I call a 90-10 rule, which means 90% of the time, 90% of what they're putting in their mouth, in their body, works for them. If they are exposed to their food intolerances by eating takeout or at someone else's house, as long as they go back to eating the way they know they need to at home, they can bounce back. They'll have some digestive upset. I can feel it. If I eat my food intolerances, I'll feel it physically in my joints. I've even got to the point where if I have real cane sugar, I can feel it in my gums. Or if I eat potato, I can feel it in my mouth. Like the tissues of my mouth actually respond to the intolerance now. Because you redevelop that sensitivity. Your body will tell you, like, that doesn't work for me when you get off of it long enough. But I have, you know, most people can practice a 90-10 rule. They don't go out and purposely buy sugary stuff.
I just like that you pointed out, though, too. But if most people, like, if you are, like, for me, I can't do 90-10. Like, I'm a true sugar addict and I have to abstain 100%, but that isn't everybody. So I think that's a really important distinction I just want to point out. And you probably know if you're listening what category you fall in, because for a while I wished I was in that other category, but that wasn't true for me. But there are a ton of people that are, and then just other food intolerances besides sugar that they can kind of get back to that 90-10. So yeah, I do think that's important to just point out, because it doesn't mean giving it up forever for everyone, you know? So.
Yeah, not necessarily. And just also recognizing that cane. So in this case, I'm talking about cane sugar, anything derived from cane sugar or sugar beet. So it's what you think of as sugar, but it's also sugar derivatives. So like molasses or nutritional yeast cultured from molasses also would be something that would be irritating to the system. So again, with that power, with the power of self-awareness and self-understanding, like you have discovered that you have an addictive cycle with sugar, that you need to just abstain from sugar, but you got there somehow. So a lot of people don't realize that because it's just so prevalent, it's in everything. And they've got an addictive cycle with food. Excuse me. Like, I've worked with people with eating disorders, and a lot of times the eating disorder would be triggered by eating their food intolerances. And when they were able to get their food intolerances out, their relationship with food was healthier immediately. Because when we eat our intolerances, they numb us to the fact that we're full. We can eat more of them than any other food because we're not getting that sense of fullness. So we can overeat them. They're the kind of foods that are no breaks foods. You know, we just want to eat them and eat them medium. And so, you know, if there's, especially in bulimia or binging and purging cycles, food intolerances often play a huge role in that. And so just knowing which foods trigger that, people have been able to have a much healthier relationship and really recover from eating disorders, which is really exciting.
That is really, yeah, fascinating to me. So thank you for sharing that. I hate to say we're like pretty much out of time. It always goes so fast. Is there anything that we didn't get to talk about that you wanted to share with the listeners? Oh, let's talk about for sure. You're doing a
plan,
so let's talk about that. But anything else too?
Yeah. Well, I mean, I just think that I think that at the heart of what I do is nutritional counseling. I've brought in these other tools as methods for helping people really understand and discover themselves and to learn how to heal themselves and to heal these parts of ourselves that are unconsciously operating in the background. But I always start with people where they are. So, you know, I work with people. I'm located in Bellingham, but I can work through Zoom and phone and email with, you know, people all over the country, or all over the world. That's one thing. but also, you know, what I do isn't religious in any way, shape, or form. So I've worked with people of all different religious backgrounds, or people who might identify as atheist or agnostic. So I just want to really, you know, a lot of people don't understand spiritual counseling, or shamanism might sound really out there, but I just want to be really clear that these are just very practical, you know, tools for helping us heal that part of ourselves that's not physical. So I just wanted to say that. And the clinic I work with is a very, you know, practical naturopathic medical clinic. It's not a place that's, you know, that I would call woo-woo at all. But there's an understanding of this connection between the body, mind, and the spirit. And I think that our culture is becoming more and more aware of that.
I just want to jump in here and talk about, just to kind of emphasize what Shia just said about the body, mind, spirit connection and how we are coming to understand that more. And it's not woo-woo, you know, that there really is. I think that's so important for people that are looking to heal, to make that realization that there is that connection. So thank you for saying that, Shia.
You're welcome. Yeah, and I guess what I'd like to share also is that, you know, as I mentioned, I work with people across the country and internationally through Zoom and phone and email. So even though I'm located in the Pacific Northwest, I can work with people anywhere. And I'm actually launching a spring cleanse that'll start on March 10th. And the registration deadline is actually February 19th. And I understand this podcast will air on the 17th. But I encourage people to consider using a spring cleanse. Spring is a natural time to cleanse toxins and reset our metabolisms. You know, human beings, ancient primordial human beings used to have a natural spring cleanse just simply by coming out of hibernation. And the foods that were available were all the lush green, you know, spring buds and leaves and things that would naturally detoxify the body. So I encourage people to consider doing a spring cleanse as a reset. I am guiding a 3-month long spring cleanse starting March 10th. You can find information about that on our website.
Perfect. And 3 months long, and I'll link the website so people can sign up and just know, yeah, you have like once this airs, it's only about 2 days. So sign up quickly.
Yeah, if you're interested. And also I offer a free 15-minute complimentary discovery phone call.
Oh, great.
For anyone who wants to just chat about what's going on for them and how I might be able to support them with the work that I do.
Awesome.
That can be scheduled online or by calling our office.
Okay, perfect. Yeah, I think that you're such a great resource for people. And I really thank you for just sharing all of your knowledge today. I learned a few things and yeah, I just think that people are going to get a lot out of what you said. So thank you so much for talking with us today.
You're so welcome. And thank you. And thank you so much for doing the work that you're doing in the world. Because I think one of the things I've found is that having community around making these massive changes that seem completely radical in our culture, just do something as radical as quit sugar. community is hugely important. Doing this with family and friends, having friends that are also mindful of what they eat. Those are some of the most, you know, foundational aspects of the most success that I've seen with patients, is just really having family, friends, and community to eat with who understand and support them.
I agree.
Making those changes.
Well said. Thank you again.
You're welcome. Thank you.
Thank you so much for listening. Have a great day, and remember, life is so much sweeter without sugar.